Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golfing community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, folks, and welcome in to this week's edition of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I've got an amazing show for you this week. In part one of the show, I'm going to be joined by two former PGA Tour pros and David Peoples and Tom Pertzer. David joined me last December, and he was so much fun and told so many great stories that I couldn't wait to get him back on the show. This time around, we'll talk about the early parts of his career when he won the Florida State Amateur title against a loaded field that included Jay Schrader and Jackie Nicklaus. You're going to hear that story, plus about his runner-up finish at Q School in 1982 that was played at TPC Sawgrass when our friend Donnie Hammond took medalist honors by 14 strokes. We'll also get his experiences playing in the 1992 and 93 Masters and why David chose not to go over and play in the Open Championship. You're going to hear those stories and a bunch more when he joins me here in just a few minutes. Tom Pertzer has become a wonderful friend and supporter of this show over the years. This time around, I'm going to talk to Tom about his memories of having played in the Players' Championship. We're on the heels of this year's tournament, and he played there several times from the late 70s through the early 90s. Like Scott Gump talked about last week, Tom equates dealing with the island greened on 17 to trying to play the 12th at Augusta National. We'll then go back and talk about Tom's win at the 1991 Colonial Invitational and the incredible putt he made on the 13th hole during the final round. He put his tee shot in the back lip of the bunker, then putted it off the downslope of that back lip of the bunker, and it went in. You'll hear why he never mentioned that shot to Ben Hogan during the Champions Dinners in the following years. I'll also get Tom's thoughts about the pro game. And would it be fractured like it is now if Dean Beeman was still commissioner? Looking forward to having Tom back as part of the show. He'll join me about 25 minutes from now. Coming up later this week in part two of the show, I'll start off talking with Jihei Lee. Jihei picked up a plastic bat one day at the age of 8 years old, swung it, and the next thing she knew, her parents brought her a set of golf clubs, got her an instructor, dropped her off at a driving range and told her to find her way there every day after school to practice. Again, at 8 years old, in Seoul, South Korea. You'll hear that story, plus about her time playing her college golf at Yale, later qualifying to play out on the LPGA Tour by getting through Q School, finishing 12th, and breaking 70 for the first time in her life. From there, she would later be an assistant for Michelle Wee, and now starting up her own company, Sportsbox AI, which allows us to see an avatar of our swings in 3D and compare our swing for when we've hit a good shot and when we've hit a not-so-good shot. You can overlay the two and see what you did right and what you did wrong. Oh, you want to swing like Rory McIlroy? Well, guess what? You can take that 3D image and put it inside Rory McIlroy's swing and see what he does and what you don't do and how to correct those two and match it up. It's absolutely incredible stuff, folks. Very much excited to have her a part of this week's show. I can't wait for you guys to hear that story and so much more in segment one of part two. Then we'll round out part two by being joined by Caddy Hall of Famer Dennis Cohn and former PGA of America writer and historian Bob Denny. As we celebrate the great women in our game, they share incredible stories of Madeline Mucci Turner and Renee Powell, plus Renee's father, Bill Powell, who was the first African-American to design, build, and own a golf course in the U.S. It's Clearview Golf Club up in East Canton, Ohio. So many great stories coming from those guys as we round out part two of this week's show. So a lot of great stuff on tap for you this week, folks. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me. But before we get started, as I've been saying to you guys all season long, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint. And they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Now back with me is David Peoples. I had so much fun when David joined me back in late December that I wanted to get him back on the show as soon as possible. Let me remind you about his background. He is from Augusta, Maine, played his college golf at the University of Florida from 1979 to 81, where he helped them win the Florida Intercollegiate and Dixie Intercollegiate tournaments. His teammates include a great friend of this show in Mark Calcavecchia. In 1979, David won the Florida State Amateur, turned pro in 81. He was the medalist at Q School in 1989. He won twice out on the PGA Tour at the 1991 Southern Open and the 1992 Anheuser-Busch Classic. He also won the 1990 Kapalua International by 5 strokes over Davis Love III. And over the course of his playing career, in addition to those 3 wins, he had 4 runner-up finishes, 5 third-place finishes, 23 top fives, and 37 top tens. And I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, David, thanks for coming back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for the invite.
David, I want to start by going back to that 1979 Florida State Amateur Championship. You went into the final round in 3rd place. You're trailing Jack Vecti by 2 strokes. Jay Schrader was in 2nd place, 2 strokes ahead of you. Vecti was 44 years old at the time, and this was his 18th consecutive Florida State Am. He'd won 3 of them and been on top of the leaderboard in several others. Schrader was a high school teammate of Jackie Nicklaus. You come in, you're riding a hot putter going into that final round. I read that you only needed 11 putts in the final 9 holes during the 3rd round. Talk about overcoming those 2 guys and riding that hot putter to a win.
Yeah, you know, what I remember is just how hard that golf course was. That was before they built the stadium course, you know, across the street. But they used to have the Players' Championship there, I think, for a couple of years. And, you know, played the practice rounds. And, I mean, the holes were just one tough hole after another. So in that state am, I had previously won like the MAGA Junior or something. I don't know what it was, but it was in Orlando and I played really well there. And I just sort of carried that into going to Jacksonville, going to Ponte Vedra there, and played really well. I'd been putting out of my mind. I've never putted like that since. It just kind of happened there for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And I was just making everything. And it got the guys I was playing with, got them a little bit, hot. They were a little hot about it. I remember Billy Tootin, I was paired with him for one of the rounds, and he just threw his putter up. It's like, what is the deal with you? So it was just a dream. It was a dream, you know, on the greens. It was amazing. After the third round, I was close to Vecti. I think he was leading. And somebody told me, I think it was Eric Slavinka, who played at Wake Forest at the same time I was at Florida. And he said, if you stay close to him and it's getting later and later in the thing, he'll give it to you. And I was like, really? And you know, it kind of happened that way. I played, you know, well. I kept making 6-7 footers for pars, and I don't remember what I shot on the last round, but we were close. We were nip and tuck there at about number 15, and then he blinked I think on 16 and 17, and I got to 18, and that it was I used a 2-iron off the tee because they had a water hazard up on the right side. It was let water all the way down the left, but there was a little ditch on the right side, so I had 2-iron thinking no way I can reach that. It was like, it was pretty far, and I did reach it, but it was luckily in the fairway, and ended up hitting a 9-iron just trying to lay it up, and I had so much adrenaline going, it went all the way up green to the green side. I hit it in the greenside bunker, and then got it up and down to, you know, get another shot on the win. And it was just, I was in la la land. I couldn't believe that I played that well coming down the straight. And it was just, it was ugly kind of golf too. You know, I had taken divots like as big as Jesper Parnevik. I was just swinging hard the putter just worked like a charm that particular week. It was really cool. And so they give you this, their trophy is this gigantic bowl. You know, and it's in a trunk, and I had my old 67 Volvo that was looked like a derby hat on wheels, and I drove it back home, and mom and dad were on the back door on the doorstep, and my dad came for the second and third round and watched. You could always tell he was there because you look down there and all he'd see was the bill of his hat poking out from behind a tree. So was really funny. He didn't have the nerve to stay for. He didn't want me to be looking at him on the fourth round. So he went home. So when I got down the driveway, and they were both looking at, I just flashed him a big old smile, and we dug that thing out of the trunk and had it for a whole year, and and then took it back the next year.
David, you mentioned adrenaline a minute ago, and I've always wondered, because I've heard so many of your peers and obviously watch golf over the years, and adrenaline plays a big part in how far you're able to hit the golf ball coming down the stretch. Talk about how do you take that into account? How do you know, all right, look, I'm pretty pumped up here. Does your caddy know? How do you know which club to pick when you're got all that juice kind of running through your veins?
Yeah, it's very hard. I really got lucky because I picked a club that I thought couldn't reach the hazard, and like I said, I had so much adrenaline, I hit it past that creek, and then, you know, I think I still had over 200 yards to get to the green, and I just wanted to lay up, and I thought, well, you know, I just hit a nice smooth little 8-iron down there. Well, there was nothing smooth about what I was doing, and it flew into the greenside bunker, and fortunately that's where it, you know, ended up instead of somewhere really bad. It hadn't happened to me until like the last 2 to 3 holes where that adrenaline rush came on and really played a factor. It was very hard to club myself. You know that you're going to be hitting it that far because it's sort of like a nervous energy, you know, and we all say, hey, you know, that's what you want. You want to embrace that feeling. It's easy to say, but it's not really easy to do.
David, you finished second at Q School your first time around in 1982. Donnie Hammond, who's a wonderful friend of the show,
Right.
He sort of torched the TPC Sawgrass course that year, won by 14. Hadn't been for him, a pretty good tournament probably would have broken out. But you're there. Nick Price finished third. Another good friend, Richard Zokel, finished tied for fourth. What was it like for you going through those six rounds on a very tough TPC Sawgrass course, to your point, moved across the street, and that's ended up where the Players' Championship played, but it was very young at that time. What was that like for you?
You know, I remember well how good Donnie was playing. It was the first time I'd ever seen the electronic scoreboards that they have, you know, and they would change and they would make a pretty loud racket when they changed, you know. It was just like, I can't even duplicate it, but that was when they used them as like just trying to test them out on the tour school. But anyway, I remember looking at one of those boards and Donnie was 18 under. And I was second at 2 under, and I've never seen a board with a guy that far out in front as that. And it ended up, I think I ended up 14 behind him when it was all said and done. But he was funny. He came out of the clubhouse, you know, all happy and going, "Hey, Pete," he used to call me Pee-Pee. And he goes, "Hey, Pee-Pee, we're going on tour, aren't we?" And I'm like, "Well, I know you are, but I still got some work to do here, you know?" It was funny because I think he ended up shooting maybe 73, 74 the last two rounds and still won by 14. So, yeah, that was an amazing, amazing. I wish that got more press than it did, because it was just an incredible, incredible feat. And that was when it was very raw. That golf course was raw, and it was either green grass or palmetto. It was one or the other.
Do you ever talk to Donnie and say, "Hey, what are you doing? How are you lapping the field like this?"
Oh yeah, we were. I never got paired with him, and not even close to where he was, except for that last day. I had played just real solid, you know. And once again, the putter was really helping me out. But that's the only contact I really had with Donnie was when he came walking down that from that old iconic clubhouse that they used to have, you know. And he was riding high, you know. I think he could have made it by shooting 87 or 88 or something crazy, you know. Yeah, he was a happy camper.
No doubt. What's it like for you? I mean, it was six rounds. Q school, yeah, was six rounds. It's not like it was a four round tournament, but right. you're staring down that island green on 17 and then that tee shot on 18 six times. What's that like?
Oh, it's horrible. Horrible looking, especially the 18th. That is the scariest tee shot for me that I've ever seen, because I was prone to, you know, miss it left every now and then, or, you know, frequently. And somehow I kept it out of that lake. And 17, I don't remember the weather being real windy. So, I just aimed at the dead center of the green. I didn't care where the pin was, and made it through the whole play. Because they played two rounds at the Sawgrass across the street, and then four at the play where the Players' Championship now is the stadium course. And the weather was kind of dark and cloudy, I remember, but I don't remember it being terribly windy or anything like that. So, you know, I was able to plug along there and you know take two off here, maybe three under the next day or stuff like that. I think maybe a 4 under might have been probably the lowest round I shot of the week, but I was very consistent, and it got the card.
Mac O'Grady also finished tied for fourth that week with Richard Zokel. And it was Mac's 17th attempt to get through Q school. Did you ever talk to Mac about his perseverance and finally getting through?
You know, the funniest thing, I remember talking to Mac when I was at the tournament in Abilene, Texas. The Leggett was the name of it. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I just want you to know, you know, everybody that made it through the Q school is keeping their card for next year, and you're the only one that's not." And I was like, "Well, gee, thanks a lot, Mac. That's nice of you." I mean, I couldn't believe he said that, and it was true.
No kidding.
Yeah, and it was true. I mean, I lost my card, and everybody else. It was a heck of a graduating class, really, with Nick Price, and it was a lot of very good players that went on to have incredible careers. But that was. After Mac said that, I really didn't care what he did.
Not. You got through Q school on 8 different occasions, and you were always either at the top of the leaderboard or very close to it. And I've talked to so many of your peers about Q School, and they've said it's more stressful than playing in a major. But on paper, it doesn't appear like it was that stressful for you. How were you able to get through it so well?
You know, I just figured, I thought, you know, this is a 6-round golf tournament. There's a ton of holes to play. So if you mess up, you still got a lot of time to, you know, make up for it. So just play smart, just play, you know, to the fat of the fair, you know, nothing fancy. And, you know, when you're riding a good hot putter, like I was at the time, you don't have to, you know, hit it, you know, stiff every time. So I was making my share of, you know, maybe 10 to 15, 20 foot putts, but I was hitting it in the fairway and I was hitting the greens. And I was scrambling well. So it was just a great combination. I wish that would have happened in the PGA Tour events instead of the tour school all the time. But, you know, I'll take the tour school too. That got me a job.
We're a few weeks away now from this year's Masters tournament. You were in the field in 92 and 93. What do you remember about your first Masters experience in 92?
Well, I can remember going up Magnolia Lane there and you know, nobody was there. We got there on the Sunday before the week started. And they were nice. They let me, and I took Andrew, I was holding him, and we walked down the 10th fairway, down the 11th, got down to Amen Corner. And that was something I'll never forget. That was just, and to see the place before everybody had gotten out on it and trampled on things, you know, it was just absolutely perfect. There was not a weed to be seen anywhere. Playing in the tournament itself, I got paired. I think I might have told this story before, but I was in the last group with Billy Mayfair and D.A. Wybring. We were the only threesome on the course, and we were the very last group. So as we were going around the course, we ended up maybe 5 holes behind. Everybody had left. Everybody's on their way to dinner. Nobody's out there except for the Toro guys that are getting ready to mow. You know, they were falling. They were chasing us in, really. And so that was, I thought, man, that was an odd thing. I didn't expect to see nobody there like that. So that was kind of strange, but it's still, just being there was just unbelievable. You couldn't get me off the golf course for the practice rounds. I didn't even go to the par three. I just kept playing the golf course.
Is that right? Either year did you play in the par three?
I played the second year after I realized that I should have done it both years. When you get on Augusta National and you've watched it as a fan your whole life, and you're just like, I don't want to leave. I don't want to get off this golf course. I just want to keep going around it. And because you get asked questions, what's your favorite course? And for me, that would be my favorite course I could ever play.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly understand why, because I've been out there as a patron many times. And when 6 or 6:30 comes around and the practice round is over and they want to get everybody out of there, I've been part of the last one or two people
right
off the golf course, because sometimes I just go down to Amen Corner and I'll sit in the stands at 12 or over by 13 and just want to sit there and just keep absorbing it as long as they'll let me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You just can't get enough of it.
The final round that year in 92 must have been brutal. There were a lot of high scores as I was looking back over the leaderboard. Seve shot 81 that day after having shot 68 in the second round. There were 19 scores of 74 or worse. Do you remember, were the conditions really brutal that time around?
I don't remember it being that difficult. I mean, I was really just at the time just trying to play well enough to make the cut, and I made the cut in both tries. I think they had that 10-shot rule, you know, if you're within 10 shots of the leader, either that or 45th in ties. And I made it on one of those things. And I thought that was really cool. They just gave me, I didn't really care about where I finished. I was just like, I get to play the golf course 2 more days, you know?
Yeah.
And on one of those, I don't know, I don't remember if it was 92 or 93, I did get paired with Gary Player.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, how lucky are you? Get to play Augusta National with Gary Player, and he beat the tar out of me, but that was fine. But what a gentleman too, man.
Yeah. What's it like walking the golf course with him in a tournament round?
Well, he was very focused. I mean, even though he was up there, you know, in years, I mean, not that much. I mean, last time he won, I think was 78.
Right.
So, you know, he was very, he was into it. I mean, you know, it was not a ceremonial golf round. He was playing hard. I think he shot maybe 72 or 73, and I posted a nice little 77 sunset strip on it. But it was cool.
In 93, in the final round, Dan Forsman got to within a stroke of the lead of Bernhard Langer, and then he put two balls in the water on 12 and ended up making seven. And that was kind of it for him for that year. But I've asked some of your peers, and I'm always curious, because to me, the right pin placement on 12 in the final round is sort of a sucker pin placement. I can never understand why anybody is shooting at that pin, because more often than not, the ball comes up short and then it backs up into Ray's Creek, unless you're Fred Couples in 1992. Right. For you, when standing on the 12th tee in the final round, is it just, you can't help yourself? It just looks so easy. It looks so inviting. Or yeah. How did you end up playing it?
That's exactly what it is. I played over the bunker and I missed it long once. I think I missed it short in the bunker, but good thing I took that line, so I wasn't in the water. But when you look at that right pin, it's so deceiving. It looks okay, that can't be that hard, but you know, you have to go, wait, everybody says do not aim at that. So I didn't. And, after you play it enough, you realize that water, it looks like it goes straight across, like a 90-degree angle, you know, from the shot you're hitting from the tee, and it's not. I mean, that right side goes away from you. And then it seems like it's exposed more to that wind, you know, that comes flying down off of Augusta Country Club, and, you know, when you see the flags going in opposite directions. So, you know, what I did, I just said, you know, hey, I'm only here. This is like, I played in it two times. I'm not going to buck the tradition here. Hit it over the bunker. So I think I made a couple of bogeys, but I did okay. So just taking that advice, you know?
Yeah. And I've always dreamed about what it must be like to be inside the ropes at Augusta National. So outside of tournament play, what was it like for you? Did you get to experience the other things in the champions locker room, going around the clubhouse and all of that sort of thing? Did you get to get all that behind the scenes stuff either time you were there?
You know, I don't even think I went into the clubhouse. I don't remember going in. I think there was one particular time my dad came in with the first year I played in at 92, and I didn't have the proper credentials for him, so he couldn't get in. So, you know, I went in and did my thing and got out of there pretty quickly. Yeah, I wish I would have taken the time to check that place out a lot more, but I really never had a chance to do that.
David, I noticed in your record that you never went over to play in the Open Championship. I was curious. You were such a wonderful player. Why didn't you ever go over to play in that tournament?
Well, I was never exempt. You know, I just couldn't get myself to, you know, go all that way to play in a Monday qualifier. You know, looking back on it, I should have, because I think I could have, played well. When I finally played over there, it was in the Senior British Open at Carnoustie. And I just fell in love with that kind of golf, you know, the way I putted from, I must have been 50, 60 yards out in the fairway.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it was like a green. I mean, it was that firm, and when you watch it on TV, you go, what are they doing? You got to be chipping that, you know? And no, but it was just a totally different way to play the game all across the ground.
So how did you learn that? I mean, going over there and maybe getting there a few days in advance or a week in advance and doing that sort of thing doesn't seem like enough time, because it feels like our game here in the U.S. is more of an air game. And over there, it's more of a ground game. That seems like a big adjustment to be able to make in order to play well.
Yeah, it's huge. The first year I went, and I gave myself some time to get used to the time change, the jet lag that I had. I got over there, I think about maybe 10 in the morning, and my body was thinking it was much later than that. And you're tempted to, you want to go just lay down and take a nap, but you can't. You got to stay up so that you adjust. And the first year I adjusted pretty good. The second year when it was at Walton Heath, I didn't. And I just laid down, took a nap, and next thing you know, it's like midnight or something. my body clock was all messed up that whole week, and I didn't play well. But the first time getting to play Carnoustie, because you know that was one of the ones that I think that's the first course that that was the first course that Watson won his five. He won five, and that was where he won his first. So I was always a big fan of his, and you know, I really just grooved on that place. Loved it so much.
David, just a couple more before I let you go. And just curious, all the times you were out on both the regular tour and the Champions Tour, who were the guys that you really had a great time with when you got paired with them?
Oh, always Fuzzy Zeller was every time I played with him, it's always been just a hoot. So he always called me Pebbles. And he just, you know, I remember one time I was out for a while and hadn't come back, hadn't played in quite a while. I wasn't used to being around a big crowd. And I thought, man, I hope I get just kind of a calm crowd, you know? Well, I know. And I get Fuzzy and I think maybe Stadler or something like that. So it was a high pressure feeling, you know, to be around those good players. But I would have to say that Fuzzy was my favorite.
David, before I let you go, how can our listeners stay up to date with you and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, Chris, I probably just, you know, you can find me plunking around maybe in Facebook and stuff like that. I don't really have a website or anything, but, you know, I'm always nosy seeing whatever other people are doing. So you might see me liking something here or liking something there. That's about it.
Well, David, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show again. You're awesome, my friend. I mean it sincerely. I had so much fun the last time you were on the show. I really wanted to get you back on as soon as I could and enjoy you again for a little while. You're just a treat to have as part of the show.
Well, that's just very nice of you to say, Chris. I can't tell you how much fun I've had these last two times being on your show. And you do an incredible job.
Well, I appreciate that very much. David, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. I hope we get this privilege again soon.
Same here, Chris. Thank you so much.
You bet. That is David Peoples, folks. And like I say, he was so much fun last time. He's got great stories. He's a great storyteller and just had a fantastic career, both as an amateur and then getting out on the PGA Tour and for a little while on the Champions Tour as well. When I think about the things that he has achieved and done and the experiences he's had, it's just been so fantastic to hear them. And like I say, hopefully we get the privilege of hearing some more of those stories again real soon. Coming up next is going to be a guy who is an all-time legend out on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour, a guy that won a combined 9 times between those tours, had one of the all-time great swings, and he is a 10 times better person than his swing was, and we all know what a great swing he has, and that is Tom Pertzer. Before I get to Tom, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe, and I need all the help I can get, and the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023 and they were using an On Point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lambkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lambkin. Feel is everything. Okay, now back in making his seventh appearance with me here on Next on the Tee is PGA Tour legend Tom Pertzer. As you guys know by now, Tom is absolutely one of my favorite people on the planet. He's come to mean a lot to me over the last several years. He's been a fantastic guest and a wonderful supporter of the show. Let me remind you a little bit about his background. He's from Des Moines, Iowa, played his college golf at Arizona State from 1970 to 73 and turned pro a little bit later on in the year in 73. Got his first tour victory at the 1977 Glen Campbell Los Angeles Open, defeating Lanny Watkins by a stroke. Tom won five times on the PGA Tour, four more times out on the Champions Tour. In all, he has 15 professional wins. He's always been known for having one of the all-time great swings, and he is an all-time favorite guest here on Next on the Tee, and I couldn't be more excited. He is back with me again this week. Hey, Tom, how are you, my friend?
Hey, Chris. Awesome. It's always a privilege to come back on your show.
Tom, I want to start by getting your thoughts on the Players' Championship or on the heels of this year's tournament. You had a couple of top 25 finishes out there in the early 80s. You tied for ninth in 87, tied for third in 1990. What are some of your favorite memories from being a part of that tournament?
You know, just getting to be a part of that tournament is pretty special. For me, it's as much of a major as any of the four majors. You know, it's always had the best field every year in and year out. It's on a great golf course, and you know, it's a golf course that if you're playing good, you can score, which we've seen the last few years. You know, Scotty. What a finish we had this year with Scotty and Xander and
right.
Just incredible finish. And, you know, Scotty is just such a good player. It's scary how good his iron play is. I'm just amazed every time I watch him play. But, you know, it was just fun. Always fun going there. You know, they treat you great. You know, and it's a huge tournament.
So to that end, Tom, I mean, there are five majors out on the Champions Tour. There are five majors out on the LPGA Tour. Are you surprised after all these years that we still haven't got the Players' Championship to become a fifth major?
Well, for sure. And I don't know. I don't know what it would take. You know, it has the credentials are there. You know, it's like I said, best field, great golf course. I don't know what it would take to change the minds of the powers to be, but I think certainly in the minds of the players, it's a major.
Tom, you've stared down that island green on 17 and the intimidating tee shot on 18 many times. And I'm guessing over the course of the years that you were a part of that tournament, the winds were up from time to time. Talk about what it's like standing on those two tee boxes when the winds are up, trying to hit a ball on the green or into the fairway.
17 is, I don't know, for the first, I don't know, first bunch of years, I never hit a ball in the water on 17. And then one of the years I did hit one in the water. And from that point on, that's all I thought about. I mean, you know, two or three holes before that hole, before 17, you're thinking about that shot. But it wasn't until I hit one in the water that it was a thought. You know, before, I mean, you could almost throw the ball on the green. It's, you know, but like you said, it's like 12 at Augusta in that the wind plays so much of an effect on that shot. You know, like 12 at Augusta, you always wanted to look at the flagstick on 11 to see what the wind was doing, because once you got over to the 12th tee, the wind kind of swirled that back in that amen corner there. And so you really had to pay attention to what the wind was doing on 11. I think Kenny Venturi maybe was one of the first guys to mention that. And I remembered him saying that. So kind of always did that. And but 17, you know, it's just, you have an idea of what the wind's doing, but it, you know, if the wind's behind you, it pushes the ball down. You know, any kind of a crosswind, it all of a sudden makes that shot a lot harder. So it was, you know, it's a great little finishing hole. And you just have to step up there and, you know, stay positive and make a good swing. And hopefully it goes where you want it to, but it's a scary little shot. And then 18, you walk over to 18 and, you know, you want, there's no really place to bail out. You know, if you hit it to the right where you think there's a bailout, now you've got no shot because those pine trees come in the way. But it's a tough shot. You just got to get up there, pick your target, and make a good swing as you can, and hopefully it does what you want it to. But it's a really good finishing hole. I'm amazed at how far the kids hit it these days, where, you know, they hit three woods drivers down there and they've got, you know, kind of a short iron in. But you know, it's just a great finishing, the last few holes there, great finishing holes.
Yeah. I had John Mahaffey on the show last week and he said 17 could end up being the shortest par five you've ever played. And, Scott Gump talked about, to your point about 17 and 12 at Augusta National, that trying to figure out the winds on those two holes were some of the hardest things he had to do, because to your point, they would swirl, and it's really hard to figure out which way is going to affect your ball until almost you get it up in the air.
Exactly. And it can change. It changes so quickly there that you don't know, you know, you're standing over the ball and all of a sudden you feel the wind come in a different direction. And all of a sudden now it messes with your head. So it's a tough little shot.
You mentioned that, you know, hole getting in your head. We've seen 12 get in Jordan Spieth's head over the last several years. When you've got the negative thoughts all of a sudden creeping in, like what could go wrong instead of what could go right, how do you deal with that? How do you get that and try to block that out? Because I imagine if you let it run wild, you're sunk.
Yeah, you definitely, it is tough. You know, you just have to, but that's the game. That's what makes this game so great, is that you've got to push out all the negative thoughts, because they run rampant in your head. And I was fortunate enough to play with Tom Weisskopf at the Masters 1 year. And I mean, he always was in the top five there. He should have won there. And, but because he had the great perfect game for it, but we were playing the 12th hole and I think it was the first round and he made a 13 on the 12th hole and really didn't hit his tee shot. I think the pin was front left and he hit a 9-iron. Great looking shot, just hit on the bank and came back in the water. And then he hit a couple more pit shots, pretty looking pit shots that just didn't quite get up on top, came back in the water. And so that thought always kind of ventured into my mind the next few times I played there. But, you know, you just got to push out those negative thoughts. And, you know, some days it's easier than others. You know, if you feel like you're playing good, it doesn't become quite as much of an issue. But, you know, if you're not playing quite as good, those negative thoughts really, and that's probably why you're not playing as good. You know, it's just the, you know, you got to control what's going in your mind. You've got to be able to control. And I think that's what makes great players versus good players.
Let's take that a step further, Tom, because you mentioned Tom Weisskopf. And I was always curious how it was possible that Tom never won there. To your point, he was always around the leaderboard. He was either at the top or in the top 5 or 10 going into the final round, and sometimes late into that final round. You remember 1975, you were talking about that a moment ago. It seemed like it was a mental thing for him. I don't know if Jack was in his head, but why is it, do you think, that Tom never was able to get over the hump, even when Jack wasn't winning, why he never was able to put on that green jacket?
I think to your point, I think you're absolutely right. I think he just tried too hard. I think he knew that he had the perfect game for that golf course. And, something would come up down the stretch. I mean, he had a lot of runs down the stretch. I think I remember he and Johnny Miller and Jack were right there a couple of years. But for some reason, he just couldn't get over the hump. You know, he wasn't, you know, that golf course is such, the greens are so difficult that I'm not sure Tom was the greatest putter. He hit it so good that a lot of times he didn't have to putt great to win tournaments. But, I think that's part of the deal. I remember the first 4 or 5 years I played there, I thought it was a putting contest. So I didn't give myself much of a chance at, doing good there. Although I felt like I had a good tee to green game there. I just felt like it was such a putting contest, but it took me a few years to realize that it's actually a second shot golf course. You know, the premium there is putting your ball in the right position on the putting surface. You know, you'd rather have a 12, 15 footer one side of the hole than you would a 5 footer on the other side of the hole. And, you know, it took me a while to learn that. But I'm not really sure why. I just think Tom tried too hard. I think he knew that he had the game to win there. And, you know, he came close so many times, just didn't get over the hump.
You mentioned trying to learn on the second shot where you needed to land the ball and where you needed it to finish on those greens. How did you learn that? Was that just over the period of time that you played, the experience of playing there year after year, you figured it out? Or did you seek out some of the legends that had played there for years and try to pick their brains?
Yeah, the thing I regret is when I first went, my first few years there, I didn't really play with, you know, some of the guys that played well at Augusta, you know, to ask them about certain. I was a little bit shy in asking, you know, certain players to play a practice round with. So it took me a while to learn that, you know, it was important to hit. You know, you would think that you could hit your tee shot anywhere because there's no rough, but you need to position your tee shot in the right area so you have a better angle at pins. And but it took me a while to learn that, you know, and I played with enough good players during the tournament to watch what they did. I was fortunate enough to play with Jack a couple times there in the event. So I, you know, kind of watched what he did. And but it was a learning process. You know, if I had it to do over again, I would have asked him one of the guys that won there or played good there all the time to play a practice round and just pick their brain and see what they thought.
Tom, switching gears a little bit, we've talked before about your incredible win at the Colonial in 1991. For folks who haven't joined us previously when you've been a part of the show, talk about that win and, of course, the amazing putt you made from the back lip of the bunker on 13 in the final round.
Yeah, that was fun. And you know, I loved Colonial. I loved the golf course because it made you play every shot in your bag, every club, every shot. It had right to lefters, left to righters. But, you know, and it has some of the best holes, I still think one, two, three, the fifth hole there is one of the best par fours there ever. But you know, I always felt like I could play good there. I kind of suited my game. You didn't have to shoot 100 under to win there. So I kind of always had the feeling that I could play good there. But that last round, you know, just things started clicking. I made a bunch of birdies that day and then finally came around to the hole you're talking about. I think it's what, 13?
Right.
And I hit the wind was coming into us and I wanted to make sure I got over the water. So I was in between 6 and 7 and my caddy wanted me to hit 7 and I hit 6 just to try and, you know, I was going to just hit a little 3/4 6 and I caught it flush. I hit it, you know, just as good as I could and got in that back bunker and I'm looking and it kind of went back on the back side of the back slope of that bunker a little bit. And it was going to roll down a little bit, but it kind of rolled up onto a pebble. So now I'm looking at that sand shot out of that back bunker. And if I miss hit it at all, it's going in the water because the water's right behind the pin there. So I got over it and go, oh, let's see. Well, okay, we'll give it a shot. Because I was putting good. I felt like all I had to do was get it about, you know, 5-6 feet and I'd make par. And then I all of a sudden, I don't know what clicked, but something clicked. And I said, there was no lip on that bunker, which was kind of unusual. And I go, crap, I can just get this thing, you know, if I just get this rolling out of the bunker, it's a downhill, you know, slope to the pin. So if I just get it rolling, it's going to get down there around the pin somewhere. And I, you know, just got lucky as heck and hit a good putt, came out of there perfect and ended up right in the hole. So it was pretty good. I remember, I think I told you this before, but Julie Inkster called, they had the U.S. the ladies open there that same summer right after we were there, and she gave me a call from that hole and she goes, Pertz, I want to thank you for your putt there on during the Colonial Invitational, because you couldn't putt out of this bunker now if it was they had changed the whole bunker
because you made that putt,
because I mean, yeah, I don't think the members liked that too much. Yeah, and I just remember going back the next year for press day, and they wanted to take me out there and recreate, you know, that shot. So they did away with the lip, and it looked just like I had it. And it was about the I said, I'll be here 100 putts, and I won't make it. And I think on the third putt, I made it.
Wow.
So I guess it wasn't that hard of a shot after all.
So let's take that a half step further too, because to your point, you weren't anywhere on the leaderboard as late as the sixth hole in that final round. And then you ran up 4 birdies in a row. You make that putt from the bunker. I mean, when that putt drops, you're thinking to yourself, this just must be my day.
Well, yeah. I mean, once you get rolling, you know, like you said earlier, I didn't have any of those negative thoughts that day. You know, I knew that I was hitting the ball good, and I had just changed my putting a couple weeks before that. I was more over the ball, and I was putting great. And you just get into a little rhythm and a groove, and you start making some putts, and you go, man, if I just get it anywhere near the hole, I have a feeling that I can make putts. And I remember making a good putt on the 11th hole, that par 5. And I felt like that kind of really set the tone for the rest of the day. You know, I hit a really good putt, made a birdie there. And I just kind of, like you said, kind of felt like, hey, this is my day. And you know, the one thing I remember about that winning that day was I was playing with Tom Watson, and I had always respected him so much. And it meant a lot that, you know, that I was playing good with, you know, with him in the group. And I remember getting on the 18th green and two, and I had about a 30 footer. And he walked by and he said, you know, you two putt that and you're the champ. So, you know, it's stuff like that that you remember and you treasure to have a guy like him, you know, say something like that to you. It meant a lot.
Mr. Hogan was still alive at that time when you won it that year. Did he ever talk to you about being the champ, winning that tournament and that putt in the bunker?
No, I got to sit next to Mr. Hogan at the champions dinner that next year. We were up on the head table and I didn't even mention that putt out of the bunker. No, I didn't. He didn't mention it. I didn't mention it. But he was, what a nice man he was. He was so nice to me that night. And, you know, very, you know, he said, boy, you know, what a great tournament you had last year. I mean, he knew, but yeah, Chris, I wasn't going to bring up that putt out of the. I don't think that would be one of Ben's, Mr. Hogan's. so I didn't broach that subject.
There's a wall of champions there at Colonial. When you went back each year after winning, what did it mean to you to see your name up on that wall?
Oh, wow. What an honor. And the cool thing is it's going to be there forever. And so many names, so many of the greats are on that wall. So it just meant, it meant a lot and it means a lot. I went back and played a couple years ago. I played there. I came back and played, played around there, and just knowing that it's up there on that first tee box is pretty special. It meant a lot to win that event because, you know, it's one of the tournaments that I think everybody wants to win. There's so much history there. So I think it's an important tournament, as they all are, but, this one was pretty special, and it just means a lot that that's going to be up there forever.
Tom, just one more before I let you go. And as we look at the state of our game right now, it's obviously fractured between having the LIV Golf Tour and the PGA Tour, and a lot of things are up in the air, and it just doesn't feel right now. But I want to get your thought on where we are in the game, and if Dean Beaman was still commissioner of the PGA Tour, would we be here right now?
No, I don't think so. You know, Dean had a presence, and you know, Dean was always one step ahead of everybody else. He was very intelligent, and you know, he was a player, and smart as a whip. And I don't think this would ever happen. And you know, I don't know whether I can say this or not, but for me personally, I think if somebody else was in charge of LIV besides Craig, I think the PGA Tour would have talked to them in the very beginning. You know, there's a great dislike between the two. I know Greg hates the tour and the tour doesn't like Greg much. So I think that has some bearing on what's happened. And like you said, it's just a shame that this whole thing has come about. You know, Greg tried to do this in the early 90s. He wanted to take the 40 best players off of the PGA Tour and run a world tour. And, you know, the players said, heck no, that'll ruin the tour. Arnold and somebody came to Arnold Jack in the 80s trying to do the same thing. They wanted to take those fellas, Arnold and Jack, and start a tour. And both of those fellas said, no, we're not doing that. Again, that'll ruin the tour and this and that. You know, it's just a shame, you know, that it's become so divisive in our profession. It's just, I don't see how it's going to come back together. Obviously you want John Rahm to play in every event, every tour event. And you know, a few of the other guys that went, but, you know, to me, you know, the way they're doing it, all they have to do to get their world, the points, is to, you know, play 72 holes, have a cut, have a way to get in the tournament. You know, they just think they're better than having the, you know, the classifications that you have to get world ranking points. They don't feel like they need to do that, you know. And I mean, you know, I think we've talked earlier about, the shotgun start and the, 54 holes, no cut, money up front. To me, that doesn't resemble a professional tournament. I know you kind of like the idea of having a shotgun start, but for me, the architect designed those golf courses, most golf courses, to start on one hole and to finish on the 18th hole. You know, it's always, you always want to finish on, you know, some of the tougher holes, the stretch coming in, you want those to be tougher holes. And when you do a shotgun start, yes, everybody, the weather becomes less of an issue because everybody's playing this kind of the same time. But at the same time, you know, how would you like to start on the 18th at TPC Sawgrass? You know, how would you like to have your first hole be the 17th hole at Sawgrass? You know, it just, those holes were meant to be played at where they are in relationship to 1 through 18. So to me, you know, nothing about the LIV Tour talks about championships. So it's kind of sad. I mean, I don't blame the guys for going. You know, how do you turn down the amount of money that these guys are offering? But again, it kind of tarnishes reputations.
Tom, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can they stay up to date with the things you're doing and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, I've started a new little profession. I am now, I've become a realtor here in North Scottsdale. So anybody looking for a house, let me know. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, pretty easy to find. I've become friends with a lot of, you know, some of the folks that have listened to your show. So it's been fun. And I appreciate you having me on, Chris. It means a lot.
Tom, it's always a privilege to get to spend some time with you. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come back and be a part of the show. I hope we get an opportunity to do that again really, really soon.
Well, it's my pleasure, Chris. You're the best at what you do.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Tom, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Look forward to catching up with you again a little bit later on.
Thanks, Chris.
See you, Tom. That is the great Tom Pertzer, folks. They just don't come better than that guy. Just one of the most wonderful individuals you'll get to meet on this planet and to get to spend some time with. I can't believe I've been privileged now to have him as part of the show. Tonight was the 7th time. His insights, his knowledge, and the things that he brings to this show are just absolutely outstanding. And like I said at the top, he has come to mean a great deal to me. I hope I get that privilege of having him back on the show a little bit later on this summer. That'll do it for part one of this week's show. Please come back shortly for part two featuring Jihei Lee, Dennis Cohn, and Bob Denny. Folks, I can't thank you enough for continuing to make Next on the Tee a part of your weekly golf content. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.